Welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for joining me today, as always, here on the program. Coming up in hour two, Greg Wyshynski from ESPN, little MBSW time one more time. He is in New York for game one between the Rangers and the Tampa Bay Lightning, where the accent last night was on goals. Tonight, we suspect the accent will be on goal attending with Shesterkin versus Vasilevsky. Having said that, both teams have a lot of firepower. I don't know or think that this thing is going to be a high-scoring affair, but when you consider the likes of Chris Kreider and Mika Zibanejad and Artemi Panarin, to say nothing of Steven Stamkos and Nikita Kucherov and Anthony Cirelli and Victor Hedman. Oh, I probably should have thrown a little Adam Fox into that mix as well. You know, the potential for a lot of damage. I'm not saying 8-6, but the potential for a lot of damage is there with both these teams. We'll talk to Wyshynski about that in hour two. Also, we'll catch up on the Montreal Canadiens situation, specifically with Martin St. Louis having the interim tag removed from his title. He becomes the full-time proper head coach of the Montreal Canadiens. Eric Engels checks in for more on that story. Meanwhile, big story happening this week with the Vancouver Canucks that sees former NHL defenseman Mike Komisarek named Vancouver Canucks into the player development department. He joins me now. Mike, how are you today?
Hey, good afternoon, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
The pleasure is all mine. So a couple of things here, and I want to get into a few things with your career, but what made Vancouver attractive to you? And when you read out the business card, it's one thing, Canucks player development. What does that mean for people that might not know what you do?
No, man. Well, first things first, you know, I was always, you know, since, you know, we left Buffalo, that kind of ended abruptly. You're married to these kids for, you know, 2-3 years. You're talking to them on a weekly basis. And then that kind of ends. So a little sour taste in your mouth, but you do have, it ends and then you're watching these kids go on, progress. Like, you know, I'm telling my wife, hey, I was watching the Sabres game last night up till 11 o'clock. Like, what am I doing? Is it even worth it? You know, am I wasting my time? But so there is a passion. You know, I had good mentors. I had people that saw something in me and, you know, having played 11 years, you do feel like you have a nugget to pass along to these kiddos or young men, I should say. But the thing that drew me to Vancouver was, obviously with Jim Rutherford and Patrick Galvin, the experience, the respect that they have around the league, the, you know, these guys are proven winners. They've won multiple Stanley Cups. They know what it takes. They know the recipe. You know, we're all watching the Stanley Cup playoffs this time of year, and you see how hard it is to win. You don't win a Stanley Cup by fluke. So there's a certain recipe. It's like making a good soup, right? Like, what are the ingredients? What do you have to do? Like, you could make one off, but, to do it consistently, you really have to have an understanding of how it happens. So that drew me in. You know, I had conversations with Cammy Granato and Ryan Johnson, who are going to kind of oversee our player development department. I had never talked to them or met them before, and had great, you know, conversation, communication with them, back and forth dialogue, and, you know, had their, you know, vision and what they were expecting, how they saw the role. I shared my experiences and how things went in Buffalo, and even in you know, when I got done playing, went back to University of Michigan, finished my degree, and I was an undergrad volunteer assistant coach. And you know, just I think there is, like I said before, there was I had great mentors, people that saw something in me that I didn't know I had. And you know, you do feel like you have a nugget to pass along to these kids.
And that was really good, just as an aside, that was a really good Michigan team too.
Oh my God.
Connor,
oh,
yeah. And JT Compher and Werenski's on that team. And I think Tyler Mott would have been there.
Yep.
Gee,
Andrew Kopp here with the Rangers now.
Andrew Kopp. Yeah, that's right. The Michigan ties are tight, right? Like, I know that's a big tie with you, and it certainly was with Jason Botterill with the Buffalo Sabres.
Go ahead.
I was going to say,
pause
on Michigan for one second, but I do want to ask you one more thing about how you got to Vancouver. Because my first thought is, okay, so Komisarek must have kept in touch with Jim Rutherford when he played at Carolina, wrapping up the career. Is that accurate? Was there always that, you know, open phone call relationship with Rutherford?
Not necessarily, no. I think, you know, what was communicated to me was the how much, you know, Mr. Rutherford and Patrick understood the value and the importance of, you know, building out a player development team and how it, you know, how much it means. It's, I mean, the lifeline of any organization. You know, these kids get drafted, you know, based on potential and certain skill set that they have, and then so much work needs to be done for them from the second they step on that draft stage and put on that jersey, hat, take a picture, to those first NHL games. I mean, it's a long road, long process. But back to your question. So I came in with a new regime in Buffalo with Jason Botterill, Randy Sexton, Steve Greeley, and those guys. And that was kind of my first kick at the can at the NHL level. But there was a certain approach that, especially Bots and Randy, that brought over to Buffalo, a sense of professionalism and how things are done, expectations, and, more than anything, as much as I enjoyed the role, I mean, I really got an education on how things are done, the lines of communication. What happened was I kind of caught wind of, Cammy and Ryan. You know, I know they had an extensive search and, you know, had a list of folks. And, then I start to dialogue. And, like I said, I definitely had an itch to get back into the game and the team. I mean, in the hockey world, you know, if you're not being in and around the rinks, I remember Billy Guerin told me this, when I was graduating from Michigan, he said, you know, if you're not seen in and around the rinks, you're forgotten. So I kind of, this was what, a year and a half, 2 years since we got left in Buffalo. So it was approaching that time. So when this opportunity came, I started the dialogue and it went on back and forth, their expectations, my approach and thoughts. And I thought there was a really good fit, really good opportunity. And then you kind of find out, you know, their vision with building out the department and how much they value that. And, you know, with the Sedins coming on board and, I have a relationship with Chris Higgins. I grew up with him on Long Island. He was a year younger than me. We played together in Montreal. So I just thought it was a really good fit and I got excited to work, with this staff and learn and grow myself, but also, like I said, you know, pass on my experiences and the stuff that I went through as a player. I mean, I was a first round draft pick, played in two big hockey markets, was in the limelight, had ups and downs, as everyone knows. And, you literally build a bond and a trust and a relationship with these kids. And, the ultimate goal is not to, not to have them have a cup of tea in the NHL. You want these guys to be valuable pieces to your organization on a Stanley Cup winning team. So you'd like to have a small say in that. I know it's really important, but, these kids, you kind of usher them through this whole process and then hopefully send them on their way to the big club.
With Mike Komisarek from the Vancouver Canucks Player Development Department, you talked about this early in our conversation here, Mike, and that is, keeping an eye on, kids that you used to oversee and, with Buffalo. I know some of the names that, that you helped oversee, whether it's Casey Fitzgerald or Brendan Gooley or Matias Samuelson. Like, how much are you, I know you're like a full-on Vancouver Canucks player development now, but like, how much do you still sort of in the corner of your eye keep an eye on, some of the kids that you were partially responsible for in Buffalo?
Yeah, you watch these guys. I mean, I had Jacob Bryson, like you said, Matias Samuelson, Oskari Laxton, who was in Rochester. You just want to see, obviously there's no contact, you're not reaching out to these kids, but you just watch them from afar. They're all different kids. They're all different personalities. They all have different strengths and weaknesses. And you're trying to, tailor make each individual approach. You're dealing with the kid, right? Like it's all, no two kids are alike, no two players, right? So you kind of adjust and mold your strategy, your approach, your process to the kid. I just enjoyed. I loved being in and around these kids. I mean, you're talking to them, every week. You're texting with them. When COVID hit, right, we're doing FaceTimes and Zooms. Trying to navigate. Gyms were closed. How are we going to get workouts in? Where are we going to be skating? What's our plan for the summer? You're building such a bond and relationship with these kids, and just trying to figure out. Just kind of gap those. Gap the bridge between their weaknesses and strengths, So it was really rewarding stuff. And like you brought up the Michigan thing. I talked to some of the guys, but I still even watch those guys. And you see, You know, all the success that these guys have earned is they earned it. No one else, you know, like sometimes you run into these coaches, especially at a young age, you know, they're quick to hang their hat on, you know, I got this guy, the NHL, I coach this guy, like all the success is earned by these kids. And, you know, at the end of the day, you just want to have a, be a small part of it and making sure that they're on the right track and right trajectory and, doing the right things, you know, whether it's, you know, their habits, their structure, their routines.
I'm, you know, certainly recently, but just in general, really happy for JT Compher. You know, you talk about like like I have like half my family, like when I was a kid, half my family was living in Livonia, Michigan. So we would go and, you know, everything was Wolverines. I remember going to Michigan, Ohio State football game when I was like 12 years old, and I had never seen any, like, where are all these people coming from? It was, and I know like the bonds with like anyone that's involved in Michigan run, you know, really deep. So, you know, the association that you have with Jason Botterill, that doesn't come as any surprise. I want to ask you about your playing career, and I've always admired players that aren't shy about the big market. And it's a very unique player that can embrace playing in big markets, specifically in Canada. So you played with the Montreal Canadiens and the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I've always maintained that Montreal is harder. Brian Burke puts it the best way. He says Montreal is the toughest place because, you know, when you're stupid in two languages. At least in Toronto, when you're stupid, you're only stupid in one.
Oh, yeah.
What was the difference
in both languages?
That's right.
You know, one you understand, one you don't understand, but it comes from all angles, basically.
What's how would you compare your times in both Montreal and Toronto as a player?
Yeah, I mean, it was you know, two different stories, I guess. Montreal, you come in, you're bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, eager to earn a spot. You know, Bob Guin used to tell me, you know, it's hard not only to get your foot in the door, and that door is a revolving door, you know, let's not kid ourselves. But you want to get away from that revolving door. What are you going to bring on a day-to-day basis, consistently to the team to help them win? So I was, you know, as crazy as it might sound, you might be shocked. I was a power play guy at Michigan, putting up points, Mike Camilleri feeding me one-timers, getting pucks on net. And then that clearly was not the case when I turned pro. But you kind of just tried to find, you know, what does the team need and what are you going to provide on a nightly basis? And, so Bob was great. My whole time in there, we had a young team in Montreal. We had I had great leadership with Saku Koivu. I think Andre Savard was a GM there, and he was, I think, let go shortly thereafter. So I was dealing with like Bob Gainey, and Bob was tremendous. Like, he didn't waste any words. Just a wealth of knowledge. You know, you'd sit there and talk to him for a couple minutes, and then you just felt like automatically, you're a better hockey player, you know, coming into the rink, shaking hands with, you know, Jean Beliveau. Just experiences that I'll never forget. And you know, my only regret is I wish my kids were around a little bit more to see me play and experience and get a taste of that. Toronto was a little bit different. You know, we struggled right off the bat. There was kind of, you know, coaching changes, you know, it was tough. It was definitely tough. But, you know, you learn how to, you know, deal with the adversity, the media market on the ice. There's a different pressure, right? You know, I came in, I was a free agent, I was making a little bit more money, but I was the same player. You know, now a little bit more is expected of you, and you are, you're basically the same player, right? Now you're trying to do too much. So it was just a great, regardless, I was fortunate enough, I'm blessed to this day. I'm a huge fan of Toronto, of Montreal. I watch these guys. There's still a couple friends on those teams. There's people behind the scenes that you, you know, still kind of root for and cheer. And then, you know, I went to Carolina with Jim Rutherford and, you know, kind of saw how he ran the organization. It all kind of, you know, starts from the top down, and Ronnie Francis was there. So you meet all these kind of interesting, awesome people. At the end of the day, I was, you know, I was a fat Polish kid from Long Island, and I was lucky enough. I had immigrant parents. They had no idea. You know, we're talking about player development. You know, I got drafted by Montreal, and I don't think I talked to the organization. Maybe my agent did, but I didn't talk to Montreal till I probably signed my contract 2 years later after my sophomore season. So, you know, times have changed. You know, it's a really important role, and I'm just really excited about this opportunity in Vancouver.
It should be a great one for you. Let me close by asking you about one player that I don't think we talk about enough. in hockey, and he helped so many other defensemen. He was just such a marvelous player to watch, and that's Andre Markov. And you were at the height of Andre Markov's powers as well. Like, I remember that Montreal Canadiens team. Like, there were big players. You mentioned Saku Koivu, you know, Kovalev is on that team, you know, Michael Ryder with one of the best wrist shots in the game, Sheldon Surrey with one of the best bombs from the point. But man, I loved Markov. what was your experience playing with Andre Markov?
Well, we got put together as roommates back in the day. You know, I don't know what the rule was, but you had to play 500-600 games before you got your own room on the road. And I think now it's changed. Maybe your entry level, you're bunked up, but everyone has their own rooms on the road. So Bob put Marky and I together on the ice, and then we were roommates as well. And he was really quiet, soft-spoken, didn't say many words. I'm sure, you know, you guys have all dealt with him or seen, read articles. Like, but, you know, I get him in the room. This is early on. I get him in the room. The guy would not stop talking, you know. And he just – and I tell my teammates this, like, you sure seen the Marky going off last night, like, talking about this and that. But, you know, we came from different sides of the earth, and we were so identical with like our upbringing and, you know, shared so many same values and insight. I really got to know him. He was a tremendous person off the ice, and we really forged that bond, which I think spilled over to the on ice. On ice, I mean, everyone knows what a great player he was. I mean, he was an artist. You know, Bob Gainey used to always tell me, hey, just give the puck to Marky, let him handle it. And, you know, and he literally would say, hey, you know, no knock on you, but the more Marky has the puck, the better off everyone is, right? And that's what I did. You know, the only thing was sometimes you're throwing him, you know, a grenade at his knees. He'd bat it down, you know, hit the centerman, boom, we're at the zone, right? Like, he was just so skilled. He's one of the most underrated defensemen I thought that I ever played with, that I've seen play. So he was really special. And, you know, when he retired, you know, I had got text. I sent Marky a text. I haven't talked to him in years, but basically, you know, you guys were ribbing me, saying like, "Hey, Como, you definitely, you know, you should have given half of your salary to Marky." And I, you know, we joke about it, but I couldn't agree more. Like, he was an awesome player that I had the privilege to play with and develop a relationship. You know, he would, even when I went to Toronto, he would, we'd still go grab dinners and he'd come over to my place and stuff like that. I've lost contact with him in the last couple of years, but, you know, he's a tremendous player. You can't say enough.
There are a lot of players. Like, there's a long line of defensemen that should shave off some of their paycheck and send it to Markov. And everyone that I've always talked to said he just made the game
I'm not ashamed
easy.
To admit it, Jeff.
That's how good he was. I get it. You're an honest guy, Mike. I've always known that about you. You're going to do great in Vancouver. Congratulations on the gig. Wish you and the Vancouver Canucks all the best. Enjoy the off season. I know it's always short and it's getting shorter, but you'll do great there. Thanks as always for stopping by, Mike. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate you, and thanks for having me on the show, Jeff.
There he is, Mike Komisarek, former NHLer. Played with some, I mean, that Montreal Canadiens team, man, you think of the big personalities, on that squad. And the one thing about Komisarek too, is that guy never backed down. Like, I know that, you know, he would, and every time we'd say it, don't do it, don't do it, he could not resist trying to fight Milan Lucic all the time, whether it was on Montreal, whether he was on Toronto. I don't know too many guys that actively look for it. Some get sort of, you know, shoved into it reluctantly, certainly when Lucic was at his height. But Komisarek was one of those guys that wasn't shy about looking for it, and Lucic was only too happy to oblige. I want to thank Mike Komisarek for stopping by and the Vancouver Canucks for making him available. Mike now working with the Vancouver Canucks Player Development Department. All right, hitting a break. Coming up in hour two, we'll talk to Eric Engels about the Martin St. Louis contract extension. He has the interim tag removed. He is Montreal's head coach, period. But up next, Greg Wyshynski from ESPN will look back at yesterday's game, the crazy game, the fun game, and a preview of tonight. Greg's in New York for the Rangers and the Tampa Bay Lightning. Yes, we're probably going to park a bunch of time talking about Cale Makar and what's offside and what's not offside. And hope it's not boring you by this point, but it's really become a flashpoint topic and issue as people continue to disagree from both their heart's perspective and their heads' perspective. any rate, MVSW Redux with Greg Wyshynski as we kick off Hour 2 in moments. It's the Merrick Show across the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Breaking down everything in Leafsland better than anyone. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the program. Quick update. Frederik Andersen today, Carolina Hurricanes netminder, mentioning that the injury that he was suffering from, although he maintains he was close to coming back, was an MCL tear suffered on April the 16th in the Carolina loss at the hands of the Colorado Avalanche. Ooh, that's a bad one. And he also adds, by the way, he will not need surgery. Eric Engels joins me now for comment on the news of the day with Martin St. Louis and the Montreal Canadiens and what is next for the Habs. Eric, good day. How are you, buddy?
I like how you teed that up because I don't think I ever want to talk about offsides again.
Before we get into Montreal, let's talk about Cale Makar last night and Valeri Nichushkin and the tag up and it's nonstop. Okay, so what? Not exactly a surprise. The interim tag taken off the business card of Martin St. Louis, and you know St. Louis mentioning that all the assistant coaches are safe. Your thoughts on the news we heard officially today from the Habs?
Yeah, like you said, not a surprise, and certainly not nearly as much of one as when he was first named interim head coach of the Montreal Canadiens. Because I'll tell you, back then, a lot of us kind of said, "What? That just happened?" Because we were throwing around all these different names, and All of a sudden, this one comes out of the blue. And as the minutes kind of evolved, you say to yourself, "Okay, this actually makes a bit of sense given the connections not only between Hughes and St. Louis, but the connections between Gordon and St. Louis." And, you know, then we get to his first press conference and he basically, you know, a first press conference for any coach is a real winning opportunity from a PR standpoint for that coach, right? You're going to get a lot of people on board. But he hit a grand slam to the upper deck with that one. And everybody was saying afterwards, okay, this is starting to make sense. And then he started coaching and it was really making sense. And then the season came to a close with them much more upbeat. And they had a 9-game losing streak mixed in after trading to Foley and Sherratt and Lehkonen and Kulak and stripping themselves down basically to the screws. But, you know, the team showed up and played hard every night and gave something, and the individuals got better and the team itself got better, and they didn't present like a 32nd place team, and their record wasn't reflective of a 32nd place team under St. Louis over those 37 games. So my reaction to the news is, this was something that was going to happen. That's why Kent Hughes wasn't worried about the delay and this and that. That's why Martin St. Louis said it wasn't a long negotiation. It might have taken time to get done, but there were other priorities. Like, they were focused on the draft and the combine and the world championships to the point where they weren't even concerned about getting this deal done. And I think he's the right man for the job right now. What he's going to have to prove is he's the right man for the job, and the expectations rise and there's pressure to win.
You know, Montreal is a fascinating squad. And, you know, right now, like after the show, like tomorrow morning, I'm getting up early and I'm driving to Buffalo for the scouting combine interviews for the past couple of days. The Montreal Canadiens had dinner with Shane Wright 2 days ago. I think the formal interview might be today or maybe tomorrow with Shane Wright. I mean, this is a crucial time for this organization. First overall draft pick. There's a number to choose from. Shane Wright, you know, certainly from a lot of people's point of view, headlines this class. Yuri Slafkovsky, Logan Cooley as well. I know the temptation to, you know, run up the gut with Shane Wright and Nick Suzuki for the next 10 years is right there for the Montreal Canadiens. This is Kent Hughes' first draft as GM of the Montreal Canadiens. Are you able to read any tea leaves right now as to which way they're leaning or what the thought process is on this pick?
I'm going to tell you the same thing I tell all my friends at the golf course. The Canadiens don't know yet, so neither do I. You know, it's the same answer I get when everybody asks me, what's going to happen with Carey Price? What do you think? You think he's done this and that? I said, if Carey doesn't know yet, I can't tell you. You know, so it's one of those things where I'd love to be able to read the tea leaves, and I'd love to say, look, we've been looking at Shane Wright as a projected number one overall since he was 15 years old, and, you know, not necessarily anything we've seen since would cast much doubt in that situation, despite, you know, the usual scuttlebutt around the first overall pick as you approach the draft, where people say, I'm not sure he's the guy, and yeah, okay, he didn't have an explosive season, over 100 points, you know, but if you watch closely and watch enough, you see exactly what the makeup of the player is, a cerebral player, a two-way player, a center, a guy who presents himself with a lot of confidence. I wouldn't say it borders on arrogance, which is a good thing because arrogance gets you in trouble when you're a young player entering this league as a number one overall pick. Whether or not he's the guy, though, in Kent Hughes' mind or Jeff Gorton's mind or the two guys who are making the decision in Nick Bobrov and Martin McClain, who are the co-directors of amateur scouting, or you know, you've got Adam Nicholas in skills, you've got Christopher Boucher in analytics. They're all spending their time right now doing the proper due diligence on this situation so that they make the best possible informed decision. And when they say that they haven't made up their minds on it yet and they don't need to before July, like Hughes did the other day, I think that's a genuine, earnest comment, because if they were to approach it in any other way, they'd be doing themselves a disservice.
That makes a lot of sense. Carey Price, Ken Hughes, you know, talking about Price the other day. I don't know that we have any update other than, you know, when does Montreal need to know by so they can start to make their decisions?
To me, they need to know by the draft. And I asked Ken Hughes specifically, is it pertinent to know by the draft? And his answer, I wouldn't say it, you know, I was taken aback or anything, but he said, you know, it would be more important to know before July 13th in free agency if he can't play, because if he can't, then he'll be on long-term IR and we'll have that money accessible to us to exceed the cap by, you know, his value on his contract is 10.5 annually. But look, Jeff, like, I think he does need to know by the draft, which is 6 days prior to free agency anyways. You know, that's when all the major player movement gets done and affects the planning that you take into free agency and the money that you end up spending and what your needs are. And his answer to me, which unfortunately, you know, all we can do is speculate based on what he said and where they're at and that they don't have clarity on Price's situation, is that it seems as though he's preparing for the probability that he's not going to know by then. And it really, you know, what does it come down to? What are Price's intentions? Because for me, Carey Price finished the season hurt. He already qualifies for long-term IR if it gets to that, because if he decides that he can't move forward, it's because of an injury and not because he wants to retire. So What are Price's intentions, and what is Price's ability to understand his own intentions before we get to those key dates on the calendar? And I think, I don't want to say he has an obligation to Kent Hughes and Jeff Gorton, and I think they're not pressing him on it because they don't want him to feel as though he should be making this decision for any other reason than to decide what's best for him and his family and his career. But, you know, I'd like to think that Carey Price cares enough about the Canadians and his situation that he'll take the appropriate time and leading another month into July to say, am I willing to go through the same rehabilitation that I went through this past year post-surgery? Am I willing to have another operation and go through that and see if I can make another run? And if I don't end up getting back to the net, then we'll end up in that situation sometime in October, November, or whatever it is. Or do I know now that I'm not willing to go down that road because I'm too hurt and I don't think it'll be successful? I think he's got a month to figure that out, and I think it should be enough time for him to be able to give them an answer. But can't say for sure because I'm not him.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things we all wonder too is if, you know, if Carey Price, you know, can't play next season and goes on LTIR, you know, between that contract and the Shea Weber contract, I don't know that that's a place where the Montreal Canadiens want their salary cap situation to live. I think safe to say we're looking at shopping the Weber deal in the offseason.
I think so, Jeff, but I would, as a counter argument, suggests that once you're in long-term IR, you're in long-term IR, whether it's by 18 million or 10, there's not really a significant difference outside of what you can exceed the cap by if you're spending all the way to the cap. Is it a headache? Is it a particular headache for John Sedgwick, who handles the cap? Absolutely. Ask him on a daily basis what he's got to do to manipulate the roster, even working $1 into long-term IR. And, you know, he can get into the machinations of it much better than I can. But, you know, as far as Weber's contract is concerned, I do believe they're going to be able to move it. I don't know what held it up at the trade deadline, because it seemed as though something was in place. But I will say that not only do I believe they'll be able to move that contract, they're going to get an asset for it, because Weber is owed a total of $6 million on the remainder of his 4 years under contract in actual dollars. And that money's insured. His contract is insured. So whoever's taking him to reach the cap floor or put themselves in that type of situation where they can benefit, it's free cap space. So I think they're going to get an asset for it. And maybe some people will be surprised by that, but I won't be when it comes. Yeah,
I think the whole, I think they were negotiating with Arizona for the contract, and then Winnipeg stepped up with the Brian Little deal and attached Nathan Smith to it. I think that's probably that would be the one, Eric, that would make the most sense to me. I mean, Arizona got Nathan Smith essentially out of that deal.
Yeah, and I can't say for sure that it was just them. I do believe there was a couple of other possibilities, which is what made Kent Hughes still confident after the season when he was asked about it, that he would be able to move Weber in his contract.
All right. As always, excellent update. Eric, thanks as always for this, pal. You be good.
All right. My pleasure. Try to stay on side. All right, Joe?
Hang on. How did you? I gotta ask you, because at first I said no way that one's coming back, and then as the minutes and hours went on, I'm like, ooh, hang on a second here. No, that's the right call. How did you see it, real quick?
Oh, I wish I had waited, because I had a completely hyperbolic response to it while I was watching the game and caught up in the emotion of it, which I rarely get to do because I'm impartial. But I basically said it was one of the worst calls I've ever seen, and it was horrible. And I also said, I think, I can't even remember what I tweeted, but like, you can manipulate the book as much as you want to, but that's just unacceptable. And at the time, wasn't privy to the angles that were shown in intermission and the explanation that Elliot gave afterwards, in which he said, you know, we're doing a disservice continuing to broadcast, like showing that broadcast feed, which is like the opposite angle. What I don't get, Jeff, though, is that the linesman on the play is standing at the same angle that we're watching on the broadcast, in which it looks as though the puck is tethered to McCarr's stick as he's crossing the line. Either he is the most exceptional linesman in the world and was able to make that call in real time, or he just missed it. And I totally, you know, if you read Elliot's blog and you see the example of the Chicago goal, Tank and Taves, that is the most parallel situation. I was just talking with Brendan Gallagher about his goal with Tatar and that.
Go quick. We got 15. Go quick.
Okay, but really quick.
Yeah, we got 15.
We see it a million times where the whistle is blown and no goal is scored and we don't even talk about it. So to me, that's what should have happened on the play.
I knew we'd finish the show talking about Cale Makar, and there we are. Eric, thanks as always for stopping by, pal. You be good.
You're the best. See ya.
Enjoy the game tonight. Merrick Show back tomorrow.